ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Monday, the 23rd of February. I'm Melissa Clark in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. A Four Corners investigation into a top gynaecologist has revealed women repeatedly underwent surgery for severe endometriosis, despite it not being seen in their pathology results. The Federal Health Minister has asked state authorities to investigate the Epworth Hospital in Melbourne, which has also commissioned its own external review. The doctor has now retired from practicing. Louise Milligan reports.
In Thailand, Courtney Patton is trying to come to terms with what happened to her in the Australian health system.
I've had the opportunity to have a family taken away from me. I'll never be able to get that back.
By the time she was 25, Courtney had 7 operations at Epworth Hospital and had both of her ovaries and her uterus removed. After an initial procedure with another surgeon, Courtney went to see Melbourne gynaecologist Dr. Simon Gordon. Dr. Gordon did major laparoscopic surgeries on Courtney, billing Medicare for severe endometriosis. But Courtney has now discovered that's not what the pathology results from samples taken on the day of her operations showed.
He's taken the trust of a young, vulnerable woman and completely betrayed it.
Over 7 operations with multiple pathology tests for each surgery, only one showed tiny deposits, which the pathologist said was consistent with endometriosis. A gynaecologist who reviewed the results told Four Corners it was a clinically insignificant amount.
It's shattering because I put my trust with this doctor, thinking he knew best.
New mother Abby Lewis is acutely aware this could have been her. Abby had 4 operations with Simon Gordon by the time she was 21, but she's just discovered her pathology only showed endometriosis for the first 2. Dr. Gordon told her she'd need an ovary removed. Fortunately for Abby, a fertility specialist intervened.
He was pleading with me not to remove an ovary at my age when there's really no need for it to go.
Abby didn't have the ovary out and got pregnant a few months later.
I feel that he is my little miracle baby.
Clinicians made complaints to Epworth management in relation to both Abby and Courtney's cases. Dr. Gordon continued to practice at the hospital. Federal Health Minister Mark Butler has written to his Victorian counterpart, requesting an inquiry into clinical governance at Epworth by Safer Care Victoria. Epworth CEO Andrew Stripp has also commissioned an external inquiry into clinical governance to see whether the hospital's oversight of doctors' practices can be improved. Simon Gordon said in a statement he only ever performed operations on women if he was absolutely convinced it was in the patient's best interests and to improve their overall quality of life.
Louise Milligan there. Bulk billing rates have increased since the federal government put in place new incentives for GPs to not charge patients extra fees. But it's a mixed picture around the country, with bulk billing rates still lagging in some states and territories. The Federal Health Minister is Mark Butler. Minister, thanks for joining us on AM.
Thanks, Mel.
Now, first, we just heard about the case of a gynaecologist in Melbourne who was performing endometriosis surgeries when pathology results didn't show signs of it. What can the federal government do to help protect patients from circumstances like this?
Well, firstly, can I say I've read some of the testimony and it is some of the most distressing testimony I've ever read. Made me physically sick to read some of it, just a series of appalling cases. Obviously, there have been referrals to federal authorities about this individual doctor. I've also written, though, to the Victorian Health Minister to see whether Safer Care Victoria, which oversees clinical governance of hospitals in that jurisdiction, needs to have a look at the hospitals, because it was clear that there were complaints made about this doctor over a series of some years, but he continued to practice. So with those investigations, those complaints obviously have to run their course, but I just feel the deepest sympathy for these young women.
Now, I want to talk to you about bulk billing rates. We have seen rates increase over the last 3 months since the government boosted incentives for GPs to bulk bill all of their patients. national bulk billing rates are now 81.4%. How long will it take to get them to 90%?
Well, we've said over the course of the coming years, but I have to say we're well ahead of schedule. We said that by 2028, we thought there'd be 3,600 practices bulk billing all of their patients all of the time. We're already over 3,400, so we're well ahead of schedule on that. The really pleasing thing about the figures over the last few months is the big increase in bulk billing for people who don't have the benefit of a concession card. For pensioners and concession card holders, bulk billing is now back over 92%. But we'd seen it slide for middle Australia, people who, you know, are not necessarily on good incomes, but don't have the benefit of a concession card. And those rates are up 8% just in 3 months.
You've said it's ahead of schedule. So when is it scheduled to reach 90%?
By the end of the decade.
End of the decade.
Yep.
It's a pretty mixed picture across jurisdictions. In WA, bulk billing's only at 73.5%, in the ACT, 53.8%. That is a very long way from 90%. What can you do to help those jurisdictions specifically?
Well, ACT is a particularly bad jurisdiction for bulk billing, frankly, for pensioners as well as people who don't have a concession card. And we've taken a decision. We think we need to shake the market up in the ACT. And so we'll be funding the opening of new bulk billing practices, frankly, to introduce competition into a market that doesn't have enough of it. Some other jurisdictions as well, Perth and parts of Tasmania, rural Tasmania is doing very well. Hobart is a little lower than I would have liked. And also the Hunter Valley and Newcastle have lower bulk billing rates than the national average as well. So we're going to take a market by market approach to this and have a look at ways in which we can stimulate the competition we need.
Would you fund clinics in those areas like Hobart and the Hunter like you intend to do in the ACT?
We're looking at it very closely, particularly the Hunter and Newcastle, which has been particularly stubborn in its bulk billing rates. But for other markets, we're going to have a little bit of a longer look than 3 or 4 months and see how it develops. Certainly, they're all moving in the right direction, including in Perth, for example. But we'd certainly like to see a bigger increase in bulk billing rates for those markets where people haven't enjoyed the same access that some other parts of Australia have.
Mark Butler, thanks very much for joining me.
Thanks, Mel.
And Mark Butler is the Federal Health Minister. A promised national database to help stop predators working with children is at least 3 years away from working. The national system to share criminal records across state borders in real time was a key government commitment in the wake of Australia's childcare abuse scandals. The parents of a child abused by one of Australia's worst pedophiles are disgusted by the delay. Josie Taylor reports.
These parents will call David and Julie. They can't be identified because their daughter was one of Ashley Griffith's 69 young victims. The childcare worker sexually abused children over 20 years in Queensland and Italy. As Father David says, there were many red flags, but they weren't put together.
Griffith had more than 18 points of offending that could have been detected. Was subject to 3 police reports, 3 regulatory authority reports, and 6 complaints to childcare management. And he continued to offend for 2 decades.
Information that could have joined the dots wasn't shared between childcare centres, across borders, or between government departments. David and Julie have been lobbying politicians to change the system for years.
We can't keep operating at state and territory level because that's where these people exploit the system and the gap.
In 2015, a royal commission recommended Australia's 8 separate working with children checks be both unified and consistent. That's never happened. Instead, after the ABC exposed multiple childcare abuse scandals, last year governments agreed to join a $37 million database called the National Continuous Checking Capability. It was the centrepiece of a number of reforms, including a national register of childcare workers. The NCCC is designed to share police information across borders about people who want to work with children. Federal Attorney General Michelle Rowland said in August last year, governments would work together and make it happen.
Working as a team, the states and territories and the Commonwealth have made this the top priority.
But the NCCC won't include intelligence like parent or employee complaints. And the ABC can reveal it won't be fully operational until 2029, at least 3 years away. It's also not clear if Australia's biggest state, New South Wales, will even participate in the database. Here's the Queensland Family and Child Commissioner, Luke Twyford.
I'm very disappointed. I think my key message is we're 10 steps behind the people that are seeking to harm our children. Our systems are inadequate. We're not able to identify, detect and respond to people that are harming our children effectively.
In a statement to the ABC, the Federal Attorney General, Michelle Rowland, says the government is working expeditiously with state and territories and that they're complex reforms and won't be delivered overnight. The statement says keeping young people safe is a key government priority.
Josie Taylor there. Kurdish authorities have told the ABC that a group of Australian women and children linked to killed and captured Islamic State fighters might not be able to make another attempt to travel home from northeastern Syria. Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran is in Jerusalem. Matt, what's the situation here?
Mel, good morning. It seems to be one of confusion flowing from how the statements of the Albanese government are being interpreted on the ground in Syria. This group of 11 women and 23 children tried to leave the Al-Roj camp in northeastern Syria last Monday morning. They had Australian single entry passports in hand and they were travelling towards the Syrian capital, Damascus, when they were stopped and turned around by Syrian government authorities who said that their travel hadn't been properly coordinated, so they turned around and went back to Al-Roj. Now, overnight, we've heard from an official within the Syrian government saying that process was an administrative delay, that it didn't know these people were trying to leave Al-Roj and return to Australia until that mission, launched by their families and supporters, was underway. But from here, as far as they're concerned, there is no delay, although they are acknowledging the Australian government has said it doesn't want this group to come back. We've also spoken to a Kurdish official who's in charge of the camps for Islamic State fighters and refugees in northeastern Syria, in the section of the country still controlled by the Kurds, with their own autonomous government, albeit with shrinking land and seemingly shrinking influence. His name is Sheikh Mus Ahmed, and he's casting doubt on how this process will play out in the future.
The Australian government announced officially through the media that it did not submit requests and does not wish to evacuate the Al-Roj families. We hope that there will be coordination between the Australian government and the Autonomous Administration and the SDF to evacuate its citizens from the Al-Roj camp.
Sheikh Mus Ahmed there, pointing to that refusal by the Albanese government to welcome these women and children back. Now, it seems like there may be a lack of understanding of the nuance in the Australian government's position, given people like Tony Burke, the Home Affairs Minister, have said over and over that they don't want these people back, but they can't exactly stop them, given they have certain rights as citizens to return. But if that confusion is going to frustrate the travel plans for this group, the Albanese government might not be too worried about it, given how the politics of this is playing out domestically.
Yeah, and Matthew, I know that you are following the debate in Canberra quite closely as well, and we have seen the federal opposition proposing some new laws as part of this ongoing political stoush over this. Take me through that.
Well, the federal opposition is floating legislation which would make it a criminal offence to try to aid people like this group in Syria from coming back to Australia. So it's turning the sights on individuals or even charities, humanitarian organisations who might be trying to help facilitate these attempts to return. Now, the full details of the bill, of the proposal, are not yet clear, but it certainly ties in with what we've heard from the federal opposition for the last week, accusing the government of not doing enough here to block this group, even as Tony Burke insists that the nation's security agencies have only said, for example, that one of the 11 women in this group meets the threat threshold for a temporary exclusion order, banning her from travelling to Australia for up to 2 years.
Matthew Doran in Jerusalem there. A man who breached the security perimeter of the US president's private home in Florida has been shot dead. The incident happened overnight at the Mar-a-Lago estate. Donald Trump and his wife Melania Trump were in Washington, D.C. at the time. Our reporter Emily Grimenz is in Washington. Emily, this all happened very quickly. What do we know so far?
Yes, it did. It happened at around 1:30 in the morning local time in Florida. It was in the middle of the night. A car, according to early reports, was exiting the north gate of Mar-a-Lago. That's Donald Trump's private residence in Florida. As this car was exiting, a man drove in another car, and that's when police say he was confronted by two Secret Service agents and a local sheriff's deputy. They say that he was armed and that the agents fired on him and he was shot dead at the scene. This man has subsequently been identified as a man in his early 20s from North Carolina. Here's what the Palm Beach Sheriff Rick Bradshaw said about this incident earlier this morning.
He was ordered to drop those two pieces of equipment that he had with him, at which time he put down the gas can, raised the shotgun to a shooting position. At that point in time, the deputy and the two Secret Service agents fired their weapons and neutralized the threat. He is deceased at the scene.
So that's Rick Bradshaw there, the sheriff of Palm Beach. This comes at a time of heightened political violence in the US. And of course, Donald Trump has been the target of prior assassination attempts.
Yeah, that's right. Everyone remembers his 2024 campaign rally in Butler, Pennsylvania, where he was shot at, a bullet grazed his ear, and killed a bystander who was attending his rally. There was another attempt on his life a short time later that year by a man who was on the golf course that Donald Trump owns near Mar-a-Lago later in that campaign. So this is certainly a time of heightened political violence in the United States, aside from the attempts on the president's life while he was a presidential candidate. There's also been numerous fatal incidences and incidences of violence that have targeted political figures across the spectrum. Donald Trump hasn't reacted to this yet. He has been posting on social media this morning about the Olympic ice hockey men's final. His press secretary, Caroline Leavitt, though, did address the attack. She said in a social media post that in the middle of the night, while most Americans were asleep, the United States Secret Service acted quickly and decisively to neutralize a crazy person armed with a gun and a gas canister who intruded President Trump's home. Now, Donald Trump and his wife, the First Lady Melania Trump, were not at Mar-a-Lago this weekend. They often spend weekends there, but they were here in Washington, D.C. And this is certainly an incident that will trouble a lot of people who have been following the increased political rhetoric and the increased political violence here in the United States.
Emily Grimmens in Washington. Each year, a plucky band of expeditioners base themselves on an Antarctic glacier to set up one of the world's most remote airstrips. The ice runway at Wilkins Aerodrome is a critical asset, but getting it ready for flights takes extreme dedication. The ABC's Jano Gibson travelled there with the support of the Australian Antarctic Program.
At Wilkins Aerodrome, veteran pilot Dan Colburn makes a perfect landing on the ice runway.
Lucky to say this is my 21st year of flying to Antarctica. I still get an absolute kick out of it every single time.
The remote airstrip is a 4.5 hour flight from Hobart, and it's located on top of a glacier 70 kilometres inland from Casey Station, one of three permanent research posts managed by the Australian Antarctic Division.
I think the biggest thing coming into Wilkins is there's just nothing. It's just white and white and white.
The aerodrome is Australia's aviation gateway in Antarctica, catering for about 20 intercontinental flights each year. But getting the 3.5 kilometre ice runway ready for the influx of flights takes weeks of preparation.
All day, all week, we just start clearing the runway. Snow blowers, large blades on the front of loaders, bulldozers, scrapers behind tractors. We just got to pick up snow.
Jack McLeod manages the aerodrome. He says temperatures sometimes plunge below minus 30 degrees and that blizzards often force the runway's closure, ruining weeks of hard work.
Disappointing sometimes, you know, we will try everything we can, but then at the end of the day, sometimes weather or forces out of our control will just restrict that flight from coming in.
The runway only operates from late October to early March and has to close during the peak of summer when the ice runway becomes too slushy. The team maintaining Wilkins Aerodrome consists of just half a dozen people. Despite the remote location and challenging conditions, Jack McLeod says it's a job he relishes.
You will have friendships for life. I've had the lucky opportunity of working with a few of them before this season, but we cemented a strong friendship now. We've gone through a lot of hardships, but also a lot of fun as well.
Wilkins Aerodrome manager Jack McLeod ending that report from Jarno Gibson. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Melissa Clark.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. They used to be known as personal assistants. Now you can just get an AI agent to plan your day, answer your emails, and, well, organise your life. And the agents can even talk to each other. Today, computer security expert at Melbourne Uni, Shanan Conney, on how it works and whether we're a step closer to AI taking our jobs. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.